Chapter 4. Sorrow. Tess carried her bag towards Marlott. It was a Sunday in late October, a few weeks after that terrible night with Alec at the Chase. She had left Trantridge very early that morning so that he would not come after her. He had already said everything that he could to try to stop her leaving. As she walked, she passed a man painting a sign, and her cheeks burned red when she saw its words. "Lying together before marriage is a sin, and you will go to hell." The man looked up from his painting. "It's from the Bible," he said. "If you need it to be explained, Parson Clare of Emminster can tell you more. It was he who made me believe in God." Tess turned her eyes to the ground. "I don't think God believed these things," she whispered angrily.
"Good Lord, Tess,"
cried her mother, jumping up when she entered the house.
"How are you? Have you come home to tell us you're marrying your cousin?"
"No, Mother. He's not my cousin, and he's not going to marry me."
Then Tess put her face against her mother's neck and told her everything.
"But you've not made him marry you," cried her mother. "What about all the talk about you and him which has reached us here? Why didn't you think of me and your father always working? Mr. D'Urberville bought us a horse. He treats us like family. Why weren't you more careful if you did not plan for him to marry you?"
"Oh, Mother, Mother," cried Tess, her heart breaking. "How could I be expected to know? I was a child when I left this house 4 months ago. Why didn't you warn me? Men were dangerous."
Joan Derbyfield's cheeks had gone red.
"I thought if I told you about his feelings for you, you might be rude to him and lose your chance," she explained. "Well, we must make the best of it, I suppose. It's nature, isn't it?"
It was a hot morning in August, and a reaping machine, pulled by two huge horses, made its way slowly round a large field. Two groups, one of men and one of women and girls, were picking up and tying the corn left behind. The girls wore large hats to keep the sun off their heads and gloves to stop the corn from cutting into their hands. One girl, who wore a pink cotton jacket, worked harder than the others, her eyes always on the corn as she tied each armful with a cord. Sometimes she stood up to rest, and the hat fell back to show a beautiful face with large dark eyes and pale cheeks. It was Tess Derbyfield, the same, but not the same. After a long time of keeping away from the villagers, because she felt ashamed, she had decided to do some farm work. Her family needed the money, and it was harvest time, the busiest time of the year for farm workers. At lunch, a group of children aged between 6 and 14 appeared through the field's gate. The oldest one, Tess's sister, Liza Lou, carried a baby in her arms. The others brought lunch. The workers sat down to rest while the food was put in front of them. Tess reached out her hands and took the baby from Liza Lou. Then she undid her dress and began feeding the baby. The men who sat near her politely turned their faces away. All the women, except Tess, started to talk loudly. When the baby was full, Tess put it on her knees and kissed it.
"She loves that child,
even if she says she wishes it was in the churchyard, said one of the women, watching. A short time later, Liza Lou returned to take the child, and the harvesters rose to continue their work. As they rode home in a wagon that evening, the women sang songs. They seemed glad to have Tess back, and suddenly she felt almost happy. But a new sadness was waiting for her when she arrived home and learned that the baby had become sick. It was not a surprise. He had always been thin and pale, but it was still a shock. Suddenly, all that mattered was that the baby got better and lived, despite the horrible way he had come into the world. But it soon became obvious that he was really very ill, and Tess became deeply upset, not just because he was going to die, but because she had not had him baptized. It was nearly bedtime when she asked her father if they could send for Parson Tringham. But John Durbeyfield had just returned drunk from Rolliver's and decided that no parson should come into a Durbeyville's house. How he and his family lived was private, he said. He took the front door key and put it in his pocket. The baby's breathing grew more difficult, and Tess's unhappiness increased. She lay on her bed and thought of her baby being sent to hell because she'd not had him baptized.
Oh God, please look after my baby, she whispered. Be as angry with me as you want, but be kind to my child.
Then she suddenly rose up.
Perhaps my baby can be saved. Perhaps if I baptize him, it will be just the same, she said loudly.
She woke up all her young brothers and sisters, who slept in the same room, before lifting a large bowl of water from the floor. They all watched, wide-eyed.
Are you really going to baptize him? Said Liza Lou. What's his name going to be?
Tess had not thought of that, but a name quickly came into her head that she had read in the Bible.
Sorrow, I baptize you in the name of God.
And with wet fingers, she drew the shape of a cross on his head, as the children stared up at their sister with wide eyes. 1 hour later, Sorrow was dead. The next evening, Tess went to Parson Tringham's house.
I want to know, she asked. Will it be the same for him as if you had baptized him?
My dear, said the parson, feeling sorry for the girl. It will be just the same.
Then can he be buried in the Christian churchyard? She asked.
The parson shook his head at this.
That is not possible, he said sadly.
But will it be the same for him if you don't bury him there? She cried.
And the parson, because he still felt so sorry for the girl, said again,
It will be just the same.
So the baby was carried in a small box to the churchyard that night and buried by the light of a lantern in a bleak corner where unbaptized children, drunks, and non-Christians also lay. Tess bravely made a little cross from two sticks tied with a cord and flowers and put it above the baby's head. Tess stayed at her father's house, and the months passed. She noticed the important dates that passed, the night at the Chase, and the dates of the birth and death of her own baby. Her troubles seemed nearly forgotten in Marlott, but she began to realise that she could never really be comfortable in this place now. She waited for a chance to leave. Then, at the beginning of a very fine spring,
a letter reached her from a friend of her mother's, saying that a milkmaid was needed at a dairy farm many miles to the south. Farmer Crick, who owned the dairy, would be glad to have Tess working there for the summer months. So on a beautiful May morning, 2.5 years after her return from Trantridge, Tess left her home for a second time. She travelled by carriage to Stour Castle and on to Wetherbury. From there, she took another carriage to Casterbridge. She had never visited this part of the county, but she knew that not very far to her left lay the village of Kingsbere, where the bones of her ancestors, the d'Urbervilles, rested in their vault. The final walk to the Vale of Little Dairies brought her to land that was green and rich. She stopped for a moment and smelled the air, which seemed clearer and cleaner. Suddenly, she had a feeling of great happiness, and her face looked more beautiful than ever as she turned and smiled into the south wind. She stepped forward and followed the river into the farm of Talbotay's Dairy, just as a voice was calling the cows in for milking.